In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Betches Media presents.
Madam Speaker. Madam Vice President.
You want to hang out with us? And get your vaccine. Vaccine.
And so I went to Human Resources.
There's some things I just can't tell you on air.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
A woman's problem, if you will.
Hello, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Millie Tamaras.
I'm Caitlin Bird.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast, where C-SPAN meets the group chat to help you process and laugh at the biggest topics in U.S. news and politics. Of course, at the start, we have a COVID headline. Millie, I am so curious how the rest of your week went last week. How are you feeling after your COVID journey?
Oh, you know, it was really just a bad, like, 3-4 days. And then I was able to get my dog back on Sunday night. And, you know, a week later, I'm at 100%. It's been weird because I got a positive rapid test and my PCRs were delayed and I got negative PCR test. But like what I had was COVID. Like there is nothing, you know, so it's a strange, crazy feeling. And I know other people have felt that where like they're getting negative results, but they, you know, they have COVID. It's just strange. But
was it scary?
There was a moment where I was coughing a lot and then like it just wouldn't stop. And I was like, oh, shit, like I could be that small percent of people. You know what I mean? Yeah. And like that was a little scary. And like I could see my sinuses, like I felt a sensation. And I'm like, oh, my God, I was really scared to lose taste and smell because
like permanently,
because, you know, I read all the time about how someone like. Everything that they eat tastes like sewage water for the rest of their life. You know, so there's some serious shit. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you are like a poster child for mild. Like it's still, you don't really want to go through that. You don't want to be scared. Like, I feel like everybody has that moment where they're like, oh shit, I'm really sick.
Yeah. No.
When they
and like, again, I'm boosted. Like, that, you know, freshly still boosted. Very scary moment with the booster. So I can't imagine not having any kind of protection against.
I can't believe
that.
You missed Tino's first snow.
I know.
I can't believe COVID took that from you.
My dog, Caitlin, he went to the snow you saw snow for the first time and I missed it. And I had a friend documented. She sent me like 6 videos. She was great, but I was certainly sad to miss. But you know, very small.
We all.
And he's kind of dumb, so he's probably won't remember that it's snow. He barks at himself in the mirror. He thinks it's another dog. So I'm not, you know, I'm hopeful that he will completely forget about what snow is.
Mike, my fiance had to have a serious intervention with me the other day about how, like, Morty doesn't need new toys and enrichment activities. I mean, Millie, I feel like you already can tell. Like, you've only had your dog a little while. I'm constantly texting you new activities he can do. And Mike's like, he's a dog. He's not a smart dog. Every time you give him a fun activity, it's like the first time. He doesn't care. So we had to have a serious intervention with how many enrichment toys I was buying.
So
especially with this inflation going on, which will be our first topic today. Much like my ego, after getting carded at the bar, the price of goods is inflated. It is no secret. I will note for the listener, there are muted laughs on the Zoom.
I laughed out loud, but also good job, Amanda.
Thanks, Millie. I try for you. It's no secret that things are expensive these days, especially the things we buy all the time and notice the price increasing. So this morning, there's lots of drama and hysterics because the U.S. Consumer Price Inflation Index rose 7% over the past year. That's before seasonal adjustments. That's the steepest climb in prices since June 1982, so a 39-year high, but it's nowhere near the historic levels we saw in the 80s. So this is sort of a broader kind of conversation that we've been having in addition to all of our other broader conversations, which is if the price of goods is an accurate indicator of the strength of the economy or the economic recovery. Obviously, like, stuff like food and gas being expensive, like not to like diminish that. And for households that don't have a lot of income, you could easily spend it all. But Caitlin, I think last week you even like, I think we casually referenced inflation as maybe getting, being a little overhyped. So is the price of goods like, isn't the economy actually good?
Is the economy good? Well, that's a complicated question, I guess, because it really depends on what you measure. It's a little bit like assigning people blindfolds and an elephant and then asking each person to like touch whatever's in front of you. What is it? It's like, yeah. It's like, is the elephant healthy? It's like, well, I don't know. I didn't know that it was an elephant.
I would say that, like, I think that, I don't know if it's a good indicator of the economy, but I feel like it's a more accurate, I feel like when Trump bragged about how well the economy is doing, it's like, oh, the NASDAQ's up, or like the prices of stocks have gone up, or this and that. And I feel like the price of goods touches more people, and like, I hate to say like kitchen table, quote unquote, mm-hmm. issue, but like, yeah, it's like more people. And, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily a good thing or bad thing. I know families are the average American voter who's like not paying attention to punditry and politics just knows that, oh, when Trump was president, gas was this much, milk was this much, food was this much. When Biden right. was president, it was this much. You know, so I don't know if it's like a good indicator, like the political ramifications, but I do appreciate that, like, we're talking about it in this context versus like a context that only affects the 1%. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, it's also, there are also lots of statistics. I didn't think I needed to rattle them off here, but that like household savings and just cash in households is kind of up. It's kind of in some ways, it's higher than it's ever been. I mean, in November, like nearly 5 million people quit their jobs. It seems like people feel comfortable enough to do that, which suggests they feel some sort of financial security. And like, if you look at the financial recovery, it's just like economic recovery. It's kind of amazing, but I do think it gets clouded by the inflation. And again, not to diminish that really impacts people, like how much money they have to live. But I think so much of this is just like tinged by national politics anyway. Like, even if you've benefited from so many of the Biden administration's policies and they've made it so that you have more money for these things, like if gas is more expensive and you don't like Joe Biden, that's, you're going to be annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it really comes down to, just the contrast, like, we all remember 2008 and the economic crisis and the collapse, and how that was, I guess, what economists would call a deflationary cycle. Basically, people pulled a lot of money out of the economy because they were afraid to spend money. They thought that things were going to go really badly. So they need to hold on to as much cash as possible. And of course, you know, on an individual basis, everybody pulls cash out of the economy. You do it for yourself and it's a smart decision. Right. And if everyone does it, it's a bad one. Mm-hmm. And everyone pulling money out of the economy to protect themselves was going to lead to a spiral where like it would just get worse because people became more afraid and they were worried about basically what happened in the 1929 crash, which is people getting so afraid of banks or afraid of spending money or putting money into the economy at all, that banks would start to fail just from people pulling their deposits.
Yeah.
So what they did, which was not the best, but whatever, they poured a bunch of money into the economy and gave it to banks, which was not the correct decision there. They should have given it to people, but whatever. Mm-hmm. They gave it to banks, that circled through the economy, it prevented the spiral. Now we're in the opposite situation where like we had like a really brief, sudden, sharp deflationary pull as COVID initially hit and everyone pulled money out of the economy. People lost jobs. Like we all started saving, as you said, and then it went right back up. Like mm-hmm. we tried to get the economy started like within 6 months and we basically encourage people to put a bunch of money out. into the economy.
And we kept interest rates at zero for a long time. We're all
pent up, like, oh my gosh, I didn't go out to dinner for like 3 months or whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay, well now I've got all this extra money that I'm sitting on, and I want to buy, I don't know, you know, a massage chair. People started spending more money.
I don't know. That's
I don't know why a massage chair would equal the months I haven't been dining out.
Caitlin's boyfriend, if you're listening.
I don't have a massage chair. This makes me sad. But basically, people poured money back into the economy, and that's led to the inflation. So because people are putting so much in. And that's moving prices up, and now people have to pay more for labor because people are quitting their jobs. So the cost of all the goods goes up because they're trying to entice people to work for them, which is how work should work. That's how things should function. You should be incentivized into your job, not coerced. Yeah, but let's keep going with it. It's not the worst thing in the world.
I don't know. That seems to be alarming the business community, Caitlin. We wouldn't want to scare the business community. They're very, very sensitive.
The LinkedIn essays. Oh my God. Those are, and I know half of them
those
are
crazy.
Fake. I know half of them are fake, but it's also like somebody's like, can you believe that I was interviewing someone and I was offering minimum wage for this PhD level job, and they were like, I'm good, no thanks. Like, how dare they? It's like,
that reminds me, I was listening this morning, like there's still, you know, a first woman who gets to do everything, and they seem to get more and more specific as we get allowed to do more things. But I think like the Yankees hired their first minor league manager, and she was telling a story about how like on her resume, like she had multiple master's degrees and she couldn't get hired, and her name's Rachel, until she started just putting Ray on her resume, which is some Freakonomics shit. But anyway, have you guys changed your spending at all because of the inflation? Is there anything that you just like don't buy anymore, or is it not really gotten to that point for you, or do you sort of you just feel it and keep going? I mean, I don't buy dairy milk. I don't think our audience, so I don't know.
I don't know. I just moved, so everything to me feels expensive. I'm over here being like, I've got pennies and an apartment. That's it.
It's mostly meat and dairy, so I'm trying to figure out if I can just have a vegan wedding and if that will save me money.
Oh, my God. What I was going to say was, like, I think that for me living alone, you know, ordering out is expensive, but doing groceries can be really fucking expensive. Totally. Like I'm spending $60, $70 on, like, some fruit and bread, like, just some basics, and I'm like, I don't know if I like go to the bodega and get a sandwich every other day or buy like, you know, small things, like it'll be cheaper than spending all this money at the upside. Options that's supposed to be like cheaper are not anymore, I think.
Yeah, I mean, now that you mention it, that is an upside, less guilt over ordering in.
As long as, yes. You know, thank you, inflation. Now I can order on Seamless.
Yeah. So now we're going to talk about the filibuster. As we previewed in yesterday's show, President Biden gave his most forceful speech advocating for reforming the Senate filibuster in order to pass legislation related to voting rights. Let's just start out by listening to a clip. This was towards the end of the speech that he made in Atlanta. Let's listen.
Will you stand for democracy? Yes or no? There's one thing every senator, every American should remember. History has never been kind to those who've sided with voter suppression over voters' rights. And it'll be even be less kind for those who side with election subversion. So I ask every elected official in America, how do you want to be remembered? At consequential moments in history, they present a choice. Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace? Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis? This is the moment to decide, to defend our elections, to defend our democracy. And if you do that, you will not be alone.
I have to say, he's a much more powerful orator when you can't see him. I don't know why.
Well, then they started coughing, and I'm like, oh my God, so much.
So I thought of you both when we listened to this speech, because Millie, all year on the podcast last year, you know, you were saying you wanted Joe Biden to use some muscle, show a bit more muscle when it comes to this issue. And Caitlin, you've expressed concern specifically over how oblivious Joe Biden can be to just the way that white supremacy is built into the Senate. So let's start there, Caitlin. We just heard there Joe Biden went as far, or my interpretation is that he went as far as to compare those who choose not to act in this moment to those who promoted the Confederacy and segregation. That was definitely seen primarily directed at Republicans, but do you think he meant to include Democrats who are wavering too? And is that the type of parallel you've been wanting to see from him?
I mean, I was pleased by the rhetoric. The rhetoric was quite delicious. It was like a really nice appetizer at a great cocktail hour. You were like, oh, it's nice, but it's also such a small bite. It's just one bite, so you have to like follow the tray around. I want to see the follow through that treats. But if he's saying, like, you have a choice, I appreciate, first of all, him saying that there is a choice. I hope that that moves the Democrats, although he also said in that speech that he was like, don't let the Republican Party get lost. And I was like, it feels like we're a few years too late for that. Yeah. But I appreciate that you've laid out that there is a choice. And if you say yes or no, you're on one side or the other, which is what I've been wanting for years. So I do appreciate that. That is a good step. The only thing that matters after this, though, is that he treats people who make the choice like they've made their choice.
that's so great. I personally, when I get a small bite at a cocktail hour, I figure out where they're giving out the appetizers and I stand by that door. So I'm ready, and maybe I have to follow Joe Biden on TikTok to get more of satisfactory bites. But I totally agree. I mean, when I said I wanted to see more muscle from Biden, I literally meant I wanted him to intimidate.
Yeah, that's true.
No, I'm kidding. I wanted them to whack people. No. I'm kind of with Caitlin. I'm like, this is nice. This is a step in the right direction. This is a step that a lot of people were scared to take, and I think he didn't want to take or whatever. But it just feels a little late because just Republicans don't care. They're not on the same, like, it's like on one end, like, let's acknowledge the steps that he made and stuff. And, you know, I also lament about how I get frustrated at leftists for never, like, appreciating progress, or that we're stepping in the right direction, or that at least Biden will take criticism and feedback. But then at the same time, it's like, yeah, but it is necessary to have people to hold feet to the fire, because if we wait for them, like, they'll never do it. And, like, they do need to be pushed, because Caitlin's right. All of this is not in the reality that we're in right now. Republicans don't care. They're lying about a fucking infectious disease that killed 1 million people in this country. He compared, do you want to be Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis? These people are fighting in their local school districts about changing the name to, like, that's literally one of my friends.
Jefferson Davis didn't even get a Confederate flag in the Capitol. You know who did? The insurrectionists.
Well, honey, and we got Republicans arguing that they were Antifa, or that that's not a big deal, or that Democrats will move on. At the same time, what I was going to say was, one of my friends, went to Jefferson, Stonewall Jefferson High School in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I've been watching him for the past few years. In my lower points, getting into Facebook arguments with people from his high school about changing that name. So you're dealing with people who, like, so Biden, like, Caitlin, to Caitlin's acknowledgement, has been like, you can choose to be on the side of the good or be on the side of bad, and history will remember you well. We're literally arguing with people who don't want to remember history accurately, who are fighting against critical race theory. Like, so it's like, that is our reality. So even though this is a great progress of Biden acknowledging this, at the same time, it's like, yeah, but these people like Jefferson.
Right, they're not concerned. It's like, don't you not want to be in the history books about racism in America? They're like, no, we're getting rid of those books. I'm not.
Yeah, we're getting rid of all these books.
I did want to say that. I was like, he went with the whole like history. Remember, he was like, dude, have you not been paying attention to the fact that they're just removing black people from everything? They're like, oh, we're just going to get rid of all the books that mention or center black people. We're just, if we do that, then history is fixed, problem solved. Just like,
yeah. But Maya Angelou's on the quarter. I don't know why, and I know it's not my place to say, but I was like, it's a literal token.
I want Harriet back. If you're gonna give us some black women back on money thing, like, you can fix that.
Harriet, it just seems like
they took it away. You gotta replace her.
Kamala's doing Harriet, I thought. Like, I thought they accelerated the process to get Harriet on the 20, but I think
imagine
that's
if
so
that's
funny.
Like the main thing Democrats have to run on. 2024. It's like we're so close to the Tubman 20. We're so close. I'm like, what we did with the quarter. Yeah, I mean, the part that you were saying, the parts of the speech, and I know I feel like an impossible to please liberal when I say this, but there were parts of it that felt like before he just said, for the record, like it was all for the record. Like, it seems like a foregone conclusion, and he wanted to be on record saying that he recognized. I mean, because in the past he has said things like the tradition of the Senate is to debate with and to compromise with people whose views you even like hate. That has gotten him in trouble before. And that seems to be but he acts like, well, these people have just fundamentally changed, rather than this is kind of like who they always were. I guess my question is, I like the idea of him basically, I guess, ostracizing Joe Manchin, but then how do you get like anything like big, how do you get Build Back Better? I mean, this man is so obnoxious because I feel like I would love to just ostracize him and treat him like the anti-democratic monster he is, but also like we do still need him to secure legislative victories that could help with winning an election.
It's been my obsession for a long time that Joe Biden go after Manchin's right flank rather than his left. There's a certain amount of like pushing from the left side, right? Where they're like, let's try to get him over here. And it's like, there's no reason for him to, because there's no consequence for him moving further right. You know, like he's encouraged to move further right because there's no cost. So like, finally, Biden said, like, if you agree with X, like you are on the wrong side and you are amongst traitors and, you know, all of these terrible people. But at the same time, it's like, well, you, in order for that to follow through, you have to have a credible threat that's going to come. History is going to come down. You are going to impose consequences like those people faced. They'll face electoral consequences, that they'll face, you know, literal consequences for being on the wrong side. You know, there's no like wrong side of history, like, you know,
like nobody's keeping a list,
something.
Right.
Oh man, it looks like I'm on the wrong side of history.
Well, it's hard when like they're, you know, the people documenting history like is Fox fucking News, and like the media is like,
milk's expensive.
Well, it's also just like, the media. I hate to be like the fake news or whatever, but it is like we do constantly talk about political and all those publications who like are constantly like, oh, both sides are wrong, or like Republicans did this ghastly thing, but Democrats said that they were wrong. So who, they're both playing this game, and it's just like there's no, you know, objective truth anymore. So it's hard to be like wrong side of history, not. And at the same time, it's like, yeah, we do need Joe Manchin for legislative things, but I just don't see him cooperating in anything that Republicans wouldn't be down to do, which is like, so then like, it's just, that's what he's shown you for a year and a half. We're almost to midterms. Get some fucking executive orders. Get like, let's work in the reality that we have. Joe Manchin's not going to turn around tomorrow and decide that the filibuster is back. You know, he's, I personally, I don't know. I'm like, I don't see him cooperating. He doesn't like you to call him out. He doesn't want you, he doesn't want any attention, but he does want all the attention. It's just like, then just ignore him and do shit and then whatever. I don't know.
Well, I mean, to bring it back to Maya Angelou, when people show you who they are, believe them the first time. He has never supported filibuster reform. He has never supported anything really, like, won't even say what in Build Back Better he likes. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think we're just sort of holding out. We continue to dance around him, hoping that maybe he'll come around to something he's given us. No indication he will. But I think it's important, like, you know, while we were trying to get him on Build Back Better and stuff, a lot of his colleagues were sort of like, you know, I know Joe is working in good faith on this. I know that Joe wants to help the people of West Virginia. You know what? I think we can stop with that. At least stop giving him, stop coddling him. I'm done coddling this man because it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You know what? We all know, we all are used to coddling men. Sometimes they need to be coddled. Sometimes it is effective to get the ultimate outcome that you want, unfortunately. But here, it's like the emotional labor isn't even worth it. I don't need Kirsten Gillibrand anymore on TV telling us that she's trying to work with him in good faith. It's like, it's okay, girl. We know he's not going to do anything. Let's leave him behind.
He's not going to do anything. And this is, again, progressives were right. Cori Bush, AOC, they were all like, if we give him what he wants now, he's not going to give us what we want later. Don't believe this man. Let's not do it. Let's not. And guess what? Now we're fucked.
They were correct to hold the. I was completely stunned that people were critiquing them for trying to hold the transportation bill hostage. That is the only correct decision. I was baffled at the notion that we should just let this. First of all, not even very interesting infrastructure bill. We're all here. It's been like 6 months. Don't get me wrong, it's important to have federal money go towards repairing our completely damaged infrastructure, but we are not preparing for climate in any way. So we didn't do that. And then the stuff that's really important on climate, because transportation is a huge aspect of climate, so you could have put a big chunk of it there. They removed all that stuff and they put it into Build Back Better with the promise like, oh, of course it's going to work out. And now we've got voting rights, which like, we are in existential crisis, which is, you know, just like a Wednesday. It's in America. But it does require lawmakers to, you know, like, if Joe Manchin is going to be an impediment, we need some, like, LBJ level intimidation going on, to Millie's point about, like, you know, taking out something and whacking people. Like, you need to find the pressure point and you need to go in on that until he breaks, because, and you also need to, like, the 14th Amendment is right there. Like, I keep saying,
well, did you see North Carolina voters?
Section C of the 14th Amendment allows you to expel members from Congress who support insurrection. We have, like, all you need to do is get one person convicted of an insurrection, and then anything that led to support or comfort on that, you just go for it. Just expel everybody. I think those two votes should count.
And then it's sort of like, then I think it makes it a much harder decision for Joe Manchin to say, like, you know, if we're actively getting accountability and we're saying this is so serious that it violated the Constitution that we need to expel these members, maybe Joe Manchin would feel a little bit more like, okay, well, I don't want to be, okay, now I can maybe imagine the history where it's like, as my colleagues decided we needed to eject members, I was still saying, like, the reason we needed to eject them in the first place, we don't need to address. We asked you on Instagram for some questions and concerns about filibuster reform, and I knew this would be the most asked question, and it is, which is, what if Republicans use it against us? If Democrats get rid of a 60-vote threshold for moving forward with legislation and then they lose the Senate, won't Republicans then get to shove through their bad legislation without any more roadblocks? I'm very concerned about the way this would backfire, so can you expand on that? I mean, my automatic reaction is that if Republicans win the Senate, they will do this instantly anyway, so it does not matter. Like, whether it's going to happen when they win, if and when they win anyway. We're fools if we don't do it now, because it'll happen day one.
Here's the other thing. It requires a trifecta for the actual bad legislation to get through. And something I said on, the brilliant Sherilyn Ifill on Twitter, basically retweeted this concept that, like, the filibuster also shields a lot of Democratic lawmakers, and Republican for that matter, from having to put their votes on the record.
Mm.
If something is filibustered, it can just stay in limbo, and then it never makes it to the floor, mm-hmm. and then they just have to vote against cloture, so they don't have to vote against any of the stuff that's in the bill.
Yeah. And then it, we end up in these places where we're like, oh, Manchin doesn't really seem like a Democrat. Well, yeah, because we've never had an opportunity. He's never been forced to take repeated votes on super progressive
exactly.
things.
Exactly. Yeah. The longer you can hold off those votes, which is what Manchin is doing, basically Manchin is stalling for time, which is what Republicans need.
Yeah.
Republicans need time. So in this particular case, if they get rid of the filibuster, yeah, it's not going to be good. And of course, all sorts of trash legislation that pops up from the House and the Senate will make it through. But then Joe Biden is there to veto it. So at least we have that. The major thing is that's why voting rights is so important, because we yeah. need to hold the presidency.
Yeah.
We need to hold the House. Like, we are majorities of the country. Mm-hmm. And we should very clearly be in charge of things. And it's literally just the Senate filibuster that is actually in the way of us, people actually presenting their votes as they matter. Because if they yeah. were held accountable for the votes on the legislation that actually has to go through now, that might actually hurt them electorally. The
yeah.
filibuster is preventing electoral responsibility, because they never have to actually take the vote and put their voice on it. So I think in the end, we don't need to worry about that. If there's another Republican trifecta, the country is gone anyway. So let's move yeah. on from that. Let's try to keep them from getting one.
Yeah.
And let's remember we're majorities here, you know?
I was going to say that, too. Like, if we get rid of filibuster reform, then we can do progressive things like, you know, voter rights, making voting easier, same-day registration, ending gerrymandering, and get more of an accurate pulse on what, and like we've said too, like Republicans lost the culture war, like they'll never get it back. Like the majority of the country doesn't want what they want. The majority of the country doesn't want, like, wants gun control, wants abortion, some form of abortion to be legal, wants like a lot of things that that Republicans have been anti for years. Yeah. And I do think that Republicans will get a stronger people of color, multicultural coalition in spite of their shit. But I still think the majority, but with that, they're losing a lot more college, uncollege right. educated white people, you know, whatever. So I do think, so it's like, can the Republicans use it against us? Sure. But if we do it right, like, they won't have the ability to, because they will never, you know, if they get the electoral yeah. responsibility that Caitlin was saying, they'll never be in that position. And I mean, that's why they're defending it so much.
Exactly.
Because they know that if they are held accountable, if, you know, right now it's the culture wars that get, it's the people scared of CRT, not like, what policies will you, McLaughlin, put in, I'm like, that's how you say his name? Put in yeah. my life to make my life better. What actual concrete things are you going to do that are going to affect my day-to-day life? We can't point to anything that any fucking Mitch McConnell or any of those assholes have done. But we can point to, like, oh, the caravans of migrants. Mm-hmm. Oh, CRT is ruining this country. Oh, socialism. Like, shut up. Like, what actual policies have Republicans done? They don't yeah. have, they don't run on policy. They run on boogeymen. And not real boogeymans.
You're getting at another question that we got a lot that I love to answer, which is, how do I advocate for filibuster reform to people who say it's just Democrats making a power grab and ignoring half the country, since the Senate is technically split 50-50? The Senate is technically split 50-50, but you always have to reiterate and remember that does not mean it's half the country. Democrats in this Senate represent 40 million more people. So, like, mm-hmm. you know, California has also has 40 million people, or maybe has, I think Texas has 40 million and California has like 30 million. In any event, California has, say, 30 million people. They get two senators. Wyoming has less than a million people. They get two mm-hmm. senators. Mm-hmm. So you are already, it is not even, it is not an even playing field. The Senate is not working correctly. And the filibuster isn't necessarily related to that, but it is something that's not helping, and it's a very easy way to correct that, like, Democratic imbalance. Would you agree with that?
I would like to be a history nerd for a second.
Perfect.
And talk about how in the Gilded Age, but specifically in that late 1800s, early 20th century, before even the Permanent Apportionment Act of 1929, Republicans took advantage of the structure of the Senate to make a whole bunch of, like, empty-ass states. So that was deliberate. The two Dakotas, there were only two Dakotas because Republicans realized that they were able to win over smaller populations. This structural advantage, and Republicans had so much control and so many, basically had so many people in Congress, in large part because of the waning leftovers of the Civil War, which gave Republicans massive incumbency advantages for like 20 years. Where Republicans basically use this as an advantage to build in, and it hasn't stopped. Like, it never returned. There was never a balance that swept back. Like, they literally just created a bunch of empty states, and knowing that those states would basically, for incumbency reasons, almost always remain Republican. And indeed, they more or less have, creating much of the Republican majority now. So when you're looking at, like, no offense to the Dakotas, I'm sure that they're lovely, lovely states. I've never been there, but
well, it's like, and also it's like they were an empty. They were native people, but that didn't matter. Like, well, no,
they are empty.
Yeah,
like New York City,
relatively empty. Yeah, I mean, you know, like New York City doesn't have senators, but we have way more people than
Montana. All of those states, Wyoming itself,
Vermont, a blue state. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so they were designed for this. So the Senate has been abused for a long time to basically counteract large population centers. And yes, that is exactly what Republicans were doing. They realized that they were losing large population centers with new waves of immigration, that their policies and their whole stance on the slavery thing and what they emerged out of post-Civil War was not appealing to as many people. So they just figured out how to leverage more power with fewer people. And so
we've been here for over a century and a half. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think we've just accepted this as the norm. And we keep talking, well, they have 50, we have 50. Well, I asked you both if you had like a fun metaphor for describing the filibuster to people who don't understand it. I decided for me, it's like, if you have a dog and it's like 51% Great Dane and 49% teacup Chihuahua, the filibuster makes it look 100% teacup Chihuahua. Like, you're not actually getting any Great Dane qualities. You don't get the benefits of the Great Dane. You only get not to villainize teacup Chihuahuas, because I think I might have sounded I'm now paranoid that I lost followers on Instagram because it sounded like I was disparaging pit bulls, but I'm sure that's in my head. But anyway, that was my analogy. You're just not getting the majority's input.
Yeah, I like to think of it as like a pizza party. Yes. And let's say that like everybody, cheese is what everybody can eat. Like, there's a lot of vegetarians or something. But like, let's say the pizza party starts at 8. They make it so that it's, you know, or the pepperoni eaters come at 7 o'clock. And they pay for
yes,
the pizza
I see.
And make sure that, like, now it's half and half, even though the majority of the party can eat cheese. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, I think that takes it a step farther, where it's like the majority has to, like, actively take steps to improve conditions for the minority.
Yeah.
And then deprive themselves. I mean, all of these, I'm not sure if our metaphors make any sense, but clearly the filibuster doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah. The whole point is that the majority is not represented.
Correctly. And it's minority rule.
But then because it's 50-50, they make you think that it's 50-50. But really, it's like, what, 70?
Well, we won the presidency. So, oh yeah, when you look at actual population,
numbers of people,
it's like not 70, even a question.
30 or something, right? And 70 on the minority.
Yeah, it's going to get really bad soon. Yeah. Where it's going to be in another 10 years, it's going to be 70% of the country represented by 30 senators. And that's another thing is that it basically rewards, it doesn't just reward small states, it rewards states that are run poorly for losing residents and pushing them out. Yeah. Like if you just run your state into the ground, I'm not thinking of anyone in particular, but maybe also Missouri. when you run your state into the ground, you get rewarded with disproportionate power. And the ability to, so I had always thought that the best thing to do if you wanted to put in a filibuster reform rather than kill it, which it should be killed, but in case you wanted to keep it around as a failsafe, I mean, why not just allow any senators representing a majority, any coalition of senators representing a majority of Americans to break a filibuster? Anyone could put one on, but you have to overcome whoever, and we could reset it every 10 years as census happens. So basically, yes, you get rewarded for, you know, working in coalition, because the Senate was initially initially developed to represent states. It was supposed to be the state representative. That's why state legislators used to vote on senators. And then they were like, this is horribly corrupt. Let's fix that. But yeah, it rewards states for being properly run instead of what we have now, which is like, I don't know, beat the people and trap them in the state and then be like, well, cool. Now this small group of people is going to be in charge of telling all of New York and California that they can't live in a country.
Right, right. Yeah, and, you know, the huge amounts of people in Texas that vote blue.
Texas all of a sudden becomes way more important. So now Republicans do have a huge state. You just need to like make sure it's properly run. You don't lose population.
Right. You don't want them dying. Took the house though. Snowstorm. So our last question today, we've gone a bit late, is how likely are we to actually see reform? I mean, we keep pushing Biden as far as he can potentially go. I mean, we know Joe Manchin previously was appalled when his Republican colleagues decided not to vote for this, and he was given an opportunity to create legislation that they would back, and they still didn't, which gives me some hope that he might finally throw up his hands, but not much. So how likely do you think we are? Do you think the next time we'll see filibuster reform, it is when Mitch McConnell decides to do it? Sorry.
I mean, how likely are we actually to see reform? It really comes down to how much do I believe Joe Biden is going to follow through on his rhetoric from yesterday? Like, is he going to really treat these people like he would Jefferson Davis? That's what you said, man. You said Jefferson Davis. Are you serious? Because Jefferson Davis not only betrayed the country as a senator, but then was the president of the illegal country he tried to make. He was also imprisoned for like 7 years for a really long time for no reason, because they technically didn't want to put him on trial. It was fun.
Yeah.
I think that this is like the issue with like center left Democrats and more establishment Dems versus progressive Dems. It's like, what are we setting up for our future? What are like the issues now versus like how you used to work and how Washington used to operate versus the realities now versus what we're setting up for the future? And I think that is the criticism and the hesitancy amongst progressives voting for Biden in general is that he's very much stuck on like in back in the days in Washington, we used to grab a beer with everybody and talk things out and all that stuff. And then a little bit more like reactive to things that are happening now, but definitely not thinking for the future on how we're going to set things up. But I'm just curious on like, you know, it's not whether or not we're going to see filibuster reform, but it's more of like, what are we setting up for your camp for the midterms? Like, how are we going to set? I don't really see like the future of this democracy going anywhere if we don't I'm just saying, but we need to start making and taking action now to have effects in the future. And I mean, that's just kind of the criticism, right? Is just like reactionary or nostalgic, but not mm-hmm. looking forward and building and proactive and progressive. So
yeah.
I do think that, you know, the speech is a step in the right direction in terms of like, we're getting less like nostalgia about what happened in the past and more about reacting to the fact that Republicans aren't voting. But I hope that within there's some action that's a little bit more yeah. realistic and proactive that's going to set our, you know, everything up for success.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds like obviously the insurrection and Republicans coming back and still voting about, you know, voting to question the results of the election, that should have been the fundamental rupture where people stop treating Senate Republicans like rational people. But I think what it sounds like we want to see is we want to see that like a real actual rupture for Joe Biden personally and in his job and how he treats them. That's all the time we have for today. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Millie Tavares.
I'm Caitlin Bird.
And this is the Betches Up Podcast. Bye.
The Betches Sup podcast is produced by Amanda Duberman, Jorge Morales-Pico, and Sean Kilby. Editing by Jorge Morales-Pico. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Be sure to follow at Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails to suppod@betches.com. Betches.